started. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. A little business first. This is a Freaky Friday talk, and as such, the talk is followed by a movie that'll probably start about 6:30. We'll see how it does finishing up on time. But after the questions and answer period, the exit, there's an exit up there that'll open up, and you can issue out that way instead of walking right by the speaker to go out. For those of you that want to leave, then, or those of you that want to go get something to eat before you come back to watch the movie. The movie will go on at 6:30, and the movie is The Day After Tomorrow. You'll get a bit of an introduction to the climate science from Paul today. Looking around this room, I realize that a good half of you already know who Paul is. I know who a lot of you are. Paul's name is a household name in geology departments around the world. But for those of you that do not know who Paul is, I'll give you a brief introduction. He's a native of Toronto, who did his undergraduate work at McMaster University, then moved south of the border to Johns Hopkins University to do a PhD. He then worked for the better part of his career at the GSC, Geological Survey of Canada, based in Ottawa, where his main responsibility was mapping a large chunk of the Canadian Shield. In the early 90s, by the early 90s, Paul had made a name for himself around the world. He had worked a lot on, in addition to his mapping, come up with a model for the assembly of North America, the North American continent, and was one of the leaders in the effort to understand pre-Pangean supercontinents, such as Rodinia, as opposed to supercontinent Rodinia that formed about a billion years ago. So in the early 90s, Paul left the survey, and he's since then spent the rest of his career at the University of Victoria and Harvard University. And I think it's fair to say that he is most famous now after that period for working on the Snowball Earth hypothesis. His name is virtually synonymous with the Snowball Earth. Today, Paul's not actually going to talk specifically about the Snowball Earth hypothesis, but certainly he's going to, I think what he's going to talk about today probably result in part from his interest in climate science that emerged from his research into the Snowball Earth hypothesis. For those of you that know Paul, and certainly for me, what I'm always impressed by is his ability to talk with erudition about anything that has to do with the earth sciences, from mantle geochemistry to atmospheric dynamics, and I think he will impress all of us with his talk today.
Thank you all for coming. What Galen didn't point out in his gracious introduction is that he was a major collaborator in the Snowball Earth work we did at Harvard, as was Dan Tragg, who's also in the audience. So I take it as my charge today to put you in a position so that you can laugh at the right places in this movie. So these days, climate scientists are warning us that many regions in the world are in imminent danger from drought, sea level rise, ocean acidification, violent weather events like tornadoes and hurricanes and flash floods. All due, it is said, to the increases in the greenhouse gas concentrations of the atmosphere due to fossil fuel burning. There are other people who say that these dangers have been exaggerated, possibly even fabricated. And many people, hopefully including many people in the room, are wondering what to believe. And I'm not going to tell you. But what I will try to tell you is something about the history of climate science, so you can have a better feel for why climate scientists are saying the things they say. Now, I need to point out at the beginning that I am not a climate scientist. I'm a geologist. And you might think that that would be a strange background to be talking about climate science, because I think that we would agree that climate scientists could reach a very sound understanding of the climate system that we have today without any reference to geology whatsoever. However, when the subject turns to climate change, then it turns out that geology has played a rather interesting and potent role. Now, I can't tell you everything about the history of climate science and the history of geology in an hour, and so I'm going to pick a small number of informative and amusing episodes in which these two histories, the history of climate science and the history of geology, have interacted. Now, I want to begin with a one-slide preface. And this is a photograph I took on Baffin Island about 20 years ago now. And this is a glacier. And what we see here is a tongue of rock and mud called a moraine. And any decently trained geologist can recognize from the nature of this debris here that's forming a dam to this lake and this river, that this debris, this moraine, was deposited by this glacier when this glacier was a lot larger than it is now. And in fact, if I went back to this spot today, I expect that the toe of this glacier would be at least a half a kilometer back up the valley. So this marks the limit of this glacier at a colder time. And any geologist can tell you that a glacier was here, even if the glacier had disappeared subsequently completely. Now, the first climate scientist I'd like to tell you about is a physicist who got all of the geology correct, but only because he had the physics entirely wrong. So John Leslie was professor of mathematics and natural philosophy, now called physics, at the University of Edinburgh around 1800, from 1796 until his death in 1832. His mentor was John Playfair, another mathematician, but a person better known to geologists for writing the book, The Illustrations of the Huttonian Theory of the Earth. But he was actually a mathematician. And Leslie's principal protege was James David Forbes, the pioneer Scottish glaciologist. John Leslie himself was an exact contemporary of Fourier. And like Fourier, he was consumingly interested in the nature and the propagation of heat. And in this, his most important book, which is available on an e-book, that's where I read it, there is an interesting little section in which Leslie proposes that the Earth's climate is continually changing because the Earth is being heated by the sun. And Leslie calculates that the entire Earth should warm by 1 degree every 2,500 years or so simply by the heat that it absorbs, the solar radiation that it absorbs from the sun. And so therefore, he believed that the Earth's climate must be warming. And interestingly, he sought geological evidence to demonstrate that this was true. So in 1796, he and Thomas Wedgwood, the first son of the great potter, who was the son of a pioneer Scottish photographer, he and Leslie took the classic coach trip in 1796 when Napoleon's army was marauding off down in northern Italy, up the river Rhone, the upper part of the Rhone River, up to the headwaters here at a little town called Gletsch, and then over the Grimsel Pass, and then down the valley of the Aar. And here's a close-up of the Grimsel Pass area. Here's the headwaters of the Rhone and of the Aar. And Leslie describes that in both of these valleys and around Grimsel Pass, there are many ridges of loose angular stones, which the local Swiss people call moraine. And Leslie records in his diary, and it's in this book, that every tourist can see that these ridges represent the edges of the existing glaciers at a former time when those glaciers were larger. He said every tourist can see this, that there must have been a colder period. And he infers from the distribution of these moraines that the snow line, which he called the line of permanent congelation, was at least 2,000 feet lower in the relatively recent past than it is today. So if you go to the Grimsel Pass today, you can see lots of these moraines, and you can see how the Rhone Glacier, which feeds the Rhone River, here's the little town of Gletsch, has receded. But that means that when Leslie was there, the glaciers were far larger than they are today. And the moraines that we see now, at that time, were buried by a glacier. So here is the town of Gletsch in 1870, and as you can see, the Rhone Glacier isn't up here, it's right down here. So it's not altogether obvious what those larger glaciers that Leslie believed existed in the relatively recent past were, because the ice was already at that time much more extensive than it is today. And in fact, Leslie and Wedgwood's trip in 1796 was right here. This is a plot of the last 3,000 years showing the advances and recessions and advances of recessions working backwards in time of not the Rhone Glacier, but two glaciers in the same valley, for which there is good documentation. And we can see here that their visit coincided with a period called the Little Ice Age, one of the coldest periods of the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, much colder than the preceding medieval period, or the Iron Age, or the Bronze Age, which were relatively warm periods. And so those moraines that Leslie saw and pointed to did not represent these changes, which are changes only of a couple of hundred meters. He was looking at some much more profound climate change. And in fact, what he was looking at was the extent of glacial ice at the last glacial maximum of the last great ice age, which we now know was about 20,000 years ago, a time when virtually all of Switzerland was under glaciers. And of course, this was the time when most of North America was covered by an ice sheet as well. Now, this ice sheet in North America was very effective at transporting soil and rocks from the interior part of the ice to its periphery. And the net effect is that all the topsoil from central Canada is now down in the central United States. And so Canada is a great place to do geology, and the United States is a great place to be a farmer. And I believe that that accounts for many of the differences between our two countries, in both of which I've lived. Canadians are a lot like prospectors. Prospectors are people who hope for the best and seldom find it. Americans, on the other hand, more like farmers, are people who fear for the worst and find it everywhere. Now, when you think about Leslie's model that the entire Earth warms by 1 degree every 2,500 years, a little bit of arithmetic tells you that the entire Earth is warming by 400 degrees every million years. And so within a few million years, going backwards in time, the entire Earth should have been molten. And so obviously there's something wrong with Leslie's theory. And what Leslie didn't recognize was that the Earth itself is radiating. And the reason he didn't know it is that the nature of the radiation that the Earth emits, the infrared radiation, was unknown in 1796. It was discovered by the German-English musician and astronomer William Herschel, inadvertently, really, in 1800. This is his sister, Caroline Herschel, who's a pretty good astronomer herself. But anyway, in 1800, William Herschel noticed that when a beam of light is split into the various parts of the spectrum, the energy in the different parts of the spectrum is not uniform. And in fact, the amount of energy increases as you go from the ultraviolet end of the spectrum to the red end of the spectrum. And surprise to Herschel, it continued to increase into the near infrared, the invisible part of the spectrum of longer wavelength than the red part of the spectrum. And he called this in the invisible light, a form of radiation that you cannot see, but nevertheless carries a lot of energy. And through experiments, it was quickly seen that many objects, as they get hot, emit radiation in this invisible infrared part of the spectrum. And the Earth is one of those bodies that radiates such energy. Now, the significance of this first sank into this gentleman here, Fourier himself, who in 1824, McGill University was 3 years old, wrote a remarkable essay about climate. It's not a very Fourier-like paper. There's not a single mathematical equation in the entire paper. But it's a remarkable essay both for the fundamental things that Fourier got right and also for some blunders that he got that were completely wrong. Now, this phrase, which is just one sentence from this article, represents a very important concept. And basically what Fourier realized is that bodies, when they get hotter, emit more energy. And therefore, if he said, if the Earth is like that, and if it's being heated up by the absorption of solar radiation from the sun, as it gets hotter, the Earth itself radiates more and more, and perhaps at some point, the outgoing radiation will exactly equal the incoming radiation, and then the Earth won't warm up anymore. And in fact, Fourier suggested further that this might represent what's called a negative feedback. It might actually control the temperature of the Earth itself. Because if the outgoing radiation was a little bit less than the sun, the Earth would heat up until it was the radiative input and output was equal. Or if the Earth was radiating too much, it would cool down until, once again, the radiative energy balance was restored. Okay, so this was his fundamental idea, that because of this increase in radiative output as a function of temperature, that the Earth would tend to reach some sort of a balance where the incoming radiation and the outgoing radiation would be equal, would be balanced. Now, this was 60 years or more before there was any theory to substantiate this idea. The theory was worked out by two Austrian physicists around 1880. Stefan, the older of the two, inferred from various observations that this temperature dependence would actually be to the fourth power. And that makes this feedback that tends to stabilize the climate extremely powerful. And his brilliant student, Ludwig Boltzmann, worked out the quantity of this constant of proportionality from first principles, from other physical laws, and worked out what this constant should be, which was then verified with experiments. And when you can do that, then your paper gets to be known as a law. Okay? And so this is the form of the energy balance equation. I think it's the only equation I will show. And so basically, this is the incoming solar radiation. This is the co-albedo, where the albedo is the fraction of the incoming radiation that's actually reflected back to space and isn't absorbed by the Earth. This is the outgoing, so 1 minus, that's the incoming. This 4 here is simply because the Earth radiates over an area that's 4 times the area that receives solar radiation. This is the greenhouse factor we'll talk about later. And this is the famous sigma T to the fourth power. That's what drives the Earth and keeps it in radiative balance. Now, an important implication of this fundamental idea is that any change in the Earth's surface temperature is a slave to changes in the radiative output of the sun. And because at this time, all physicists assumed that the sun was a large body that was radiating heat, was losing energy, it must be cooling, and so therefore the Earth's climate could get only colder over time as the sun got dimmer and dimmer. You see, it wasn't until the middle part of the 20th century, in the late 1830s, primarily 1930s, primarily due to the work of Hans Bethe at Princeton, that it was appreciated that, wow, it's actually not true. The sun is getting brighter with time. But in the 19th century, nobody had any idea of that. So for most of the 19th century, all physicists assumed that the Earth's climate could only get colder. And of course, there was lots of evidence for that. There was lots of geological evidence that the early part of the Cenozoic, the Eocene and the Cretaceous, were much warmer than Europe is today. There were palm trees all over France, central France at that time. Certainly no palm trees there today unless they've been artificially planted. They also knew that the medieval period, from historical evidence, was warmer than the Little Ice Age, which they were still in. And so for physicists, it was a no-brainer that the climate must get colder over time. So back to geology. Now today, we accept pretty much without question, and there's abundant evidence right here on Montreal, that most of Europe and North America were covered by an ice sheet only 20,000 years ago, and that this ice sheet has advanced and retreated and advanced and retreated many, many times, probably at least 40 times in the last 2.5 million years or so. And associated with that, there was the sea level was 20,000 years ago, about 120, 125 meters lower than it is today because of the seawater that's sequestered in the form of ice on the continent. So that's something we all accept. But the idea that these large areas were covered by glacial ice 2 or 3 kilometers thick, that was a difficult idea to swallow for geologists when it was first proposed in the early and mid-19th century. So here's the kind of evidence that gave rise to this possibility. So this is a till, which is a stiff clay, stiff because it's had an ice sheet sitting on it, confusedly mixed with boulders, as the first person who described it mentioned it. Here is an outcrop that's been smoothed and polished and striated as a result of ice flowing across the surface. The ice is capable of transporting large blocks of rock great distances from their source. So up in Ungava in the Cape Smith Belt, we have bedrock that's basalt, but there's lots of granite boulders lying around on it, and the granite has to come from somewhere else. And of course, there are many landforms, most famously U-shaped valleys and lakes and fjords that we now accept were carved by ice, except, of course, initially people didn't know what to make of these features. So here, for example, in northern Europe, it was well known that there were lots of these erratic on the northern German plain and in eastern Europe, and many of them could be related to specific bedrock source areas in Scandinavia on the other side of the Baltic Sea. These are some of the famous porphyries and Rapikivi granites described by the great J.J. Sederholm around the turn of the last century. There are these features, these streamlined and smoothed outcrops known as roches moutonnées. I was told that they were called moutonnées because they look like sheep, mouton. But I wasn't very happy with that because it didn't seem to me they actually looked very much like sheep. It turns out that moutonnée doesn't actually have much to do with sheep. Moutonnée is an obsolete word used to describe what French noblemen did with a stick of lard to keep their hair pieces properly coiffed. It's an absolutely perfect description of this rock form. Now, the glacial theory is usually credited to this man, the young Louis Agassiz, who was actually a fossil fish paleontologist, paleoichthyologist. He actually won the Wollaston Medal, the highest award of the Geological Society of London, at the age of 26, the youngest person ever to receive that award. His career was meteoric in the geophysical sense of something that falls out of the sky. Agassiz doesn't have a great reputation now because he was a true creationist. He never believed in evolution or natural selection. He was also a polygenist. He believed that the human races were created separately, each with God's different intent. So his reputation has suffered mightily as a result of these unfortunate convictions. But he properly deserves credit for championing the glacial theory, although he did not originate it. And in fact, when he first started to enthusiastically promote it, he didn't understand it very well. But unlike previous people, who had the right idea and only wrote one paper and had no influence on a skeptical community, Agassiz had great personal skills, charm. He was dogged, ambitious, and he got this idea for false reasons, but he was right in the end, and he promoted it, and he created it into a controversy. And once something is controversial, then it can't be forgotten. So here's the history of the quaternary glacial theory. And like many radical ideas in science, it has a four-stage history. And the first stage is this one here, when a large number of people had completely the right idea, and they wrote one paper, and nobody read it, and nobody cited it, and had no influence on the scientific community. Here's Leslie. He's one of those. And then this is Agassiz. And so this is the short period of what I call hysteria, This is when everyone got all excited about Agassiz's idea. Some people liked it, many more people hated it, and it was a huge controversy. And it only lasted a few years, and then the interest dropped. And the theory was completely rejected then for a further 20 years. And then after an interlude of 20 years, a new generation of geologists came along who were just children when this occurred, so they didn't have any preconceptions about it. They had done work on the original features that Agassiz had described, particularly in Britain and Scotland, where Agassiz claimed that most of the British Isles were covered by ice. And they said, oh, we weren't expecting this, but Agassiz was right after all. And from this point on, virtually everyone accepted the glacial theory. John William Dawson didn't, but everyone else did. His son, incidentally, George Mercer Dawson, however, was one of the first geologists in North America to accept the glacial theory. As I'm in Montreal, I have to point out that Logan's Geology of Canada, 1863, doesn't talk a lot about it, but it's clear that he supports the glacial theory right at the outset. George Mercer Dawson and William Logan are, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest Canadian geologists that have ever been, both Montrealers. So why is this period of rejection? Now, many radical ideas in science have this period. In the case of continental drift and plate tectonics, the period of rejection was 40 years. In the case of Darwinism and natural selection, the period of rejection was 80 years. Some of my physics friends says, oh, but this doesn't apply to quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics made such precise predictions that could be verified experimentally that it was accepted right away. Except that the most famous explanation for the period of rejection, that the time is determined by the need that science advances one funeral at a time, is a quote from Max Planck, a quantum physicist. So even he saw this problem. Of course, the funeral he was waiting for was Einstein's, among others. So why was the theory initially rejected? Well, I believe the main reason was that the Swiss were looking at a different type of evidence from the people in Britain. Basically, that the glacial deposits, as we now accept them in Britain, had marine fossils in them, and the ones in Switzerland didn't. And so here was the situation in Britain. This is a till deposited by an ice sheet, and it contains rare marine shells. And the literature at this time goes to great length as worrying about whether these shells really represent marine conditions during the deposition of the boulder clay, or were the shells reworked from older deposits. And eventually they found shells of articulated brachiopods or bivalves, even articulated in the overlying beds, articulated whale bones, sometimes entire skeletons, couldn't possibly have been reworked and redeposited, carried along in ice. They had to actually represent a period when these deposits were formed below sea level, although they are today up to hundreds of meters above sea level. And this is true even when these deposits are sitting on freshwater terrestrial sediments. And so it was obvious to the British geologists that this colder period, this period of deposition of these rocks, coincided with a high stand of sea level. And that, in their view, caused them to reject the glacial theory, because according to the glacial theory, sea level should have fallen, because you're putting seawater on land in the form of ice, and sea level should have fallen. In fact, according to Agassiz's theory, because he believed that there was an ice sheet over Asia as well as North America and Europe, which is actually not quite true, his model predicted that sea level should have fallen by at least 250 meters. And instead, all the geology said that sea level rose. And in fact, the solution to this submergence problem, the problem that these deposits were below sea level when they formed, wasn't worked out until well after the glacial theory was accepted. And of course it is, because the sea didn't go up, the land went down. It was depressed under the load of the ice sheet itself. And when the ice sheet melted, the ice disappeared, the sea rushed in, the whales said, oh, we got new place for spawning grounds and whatnot, and then slowly the land rose up bringing those deposits up above sea level where we find them today. Interestingly, however, although this lack of understanding about isostasies, we call it, how the land goes up and down in response to loads that are superimposed on it, which is now the way in which we determine and infer the viscosity of the Earth's interior, this was very slow to take hold, and was not, its resolution was not responsible for the acceptance of the glacial theories. I think this is why it was rejected. Now, that was a problem for geologists. This was a problem that I'm going to tell you about next, which was not a problem for geologists, but was a big problem for physicists. And that is that these marine shells were of Arctic character. And so the people who studied them recognized that the marine shells in the Quaternary tills in Scotland are the same species that today live 1,000 kilometers to the north in Svalbard. And so evidently, since the glacial period, as we now call it, there has been a massive warming event which has caused these fauna to migrate 1,000 kilometers closer to the North Pole. And remember, the physicists thought that the climate could only get colder, and yet here was geological evidence saying that not only could the climate get warmer, but the climate could go back and forth in either direction. And of course, there was no physical theory for how the climate change could be bidirectional. So back to Fourier's essay. Now, the answer to this conundrum is actually to be found in Fourier's essay, and Fourier is often credited with this idea, although ironically, Fourier himself did not believe that it actually had any influence on climate. There is a sentence in this essay, originally written in French, but it's been translated into English in 1837, the American Journal of Science, and there's a more recent translation by Ray Peer Humbert in the book The Warming Papers, which is a collection of old papers, and which includes this one. So Fourier says, he points out, really as just a speculation, that the atmosphere interposed between the sun and the Earth's surface might have a warming effect, because it's conceivable that visible light coming from the sun passes through the atmosphere without resistance, but this weaker long wavelength radiation that the Earth emits might be partially absorbed by the atmosphere. Okay, so that would create an imbalance leading to a heating up of the atmosphere until the balance was maintained. And so he suggested this as a possibility, but he actually didn't believe it had any effect on climate. And the reason is, and we're often taught, maybe some of you have been taught, that without the greenhouse effect, the Earth's surface would be well below freezing everywhere. And of course, that's true, but it's only part of the story. Fourier, on the other hand, believed that the transport of heat towards the polar regions by the circulation of the ocean and the atmosphere was very weak. He knew it occurred, but he thought it was weak. And so he thought that polar winter temperatures represented the temperature of outer space. Okay, so polar winter temperatures are about minus 70 degrees. Now, the temperature of outer space is actually about 200 degrees colder than minus 70. It's about plus 5 in absolute terms. It's about 268, minus 268 degrees. So he was pretty far off on that. And as a result, Fourier didn't really have any need for the greenhouse effect, because he thought that that additional warming that the Earth needed, and which we believe is provided by the greenhouse effect, was, in his model, compensated by a much too warm temperature for outer space. So the demonstration of the power of the greenhouse effect was left to another person, and that's John Tyndall, a remarkable Irish-English physicist who, early in his career, in around 1860, using apparatus of his own construction, experimented with the various constituents of the atmosphere, pure nitrogen, pure oxygen, water vapor, carbon dioxide, and ethylene, and he compared the absorption of these various gaseous phases to both sunlight and to infrared radiation. And he was trying to see whether there was a difference. whether there would be preferential absorption by these atmospheric gases, these constituents of the atmosphere, preferential absorption of infrared, but not of sunlight. And he found oxygen and nitrogen, there was no difference, no preferential absorption, but water vapor and also CO2 were powerful absorbers in the infrared. And John Tyndall, who is like the Carl Sagan of his age, if there's anyone in the room who can remember Carl Sagan, was a great orator and writer, and he described the effect of water vapor as follows. He said, water vapor forms a blanket more essential to the vegetable life of England, meaning vegetables you eat, more essential to the vegetable life of England than clothing is to man. You'd kill to be able to write like that. But he recognized that water vapor could not be the cause of climate change that geologists had observed, because the water vapor concentration of the atmosphere to first order is controlled by the temperature itself. So if you have warming, you get an additional warming due to the greenhouse effect of the water vapor, but it cannot be the primary cause of the climate change. It's just a response, a feedback. It enhances any climate change, but it cannot initiate that change. And so he said it has to, therefore, be CO2. And he said, isn't it amazing that just small changes in the concentration of this trace gas in the atmosphere could account for all the mutations of climate that the researchers of geology have revealed? Now, Tyndall didn't have a very sophisticated understanding of the greenhouse effect. And I was asked what the greenhouse effect was when I interviewed at Harvard. And of course, I gave completely the wrong answer. So I've been trying to figure out what that answer is. And my present understanding of the greenhouse effect is as follows. The first important thing to understand is that the level at which this radiative balance is achieved is not the Earth's surface. It's well up into the atmosphere. In fact, it's above most of the atmosphere, including the clouds. It's around 5 kilometers above the Earth's surface. It is at the level where most of the radiation can actually escape to space. The radiation that's given off by the surface is mostly either reflected or absorbed and re-radiated. It just bounces around. It can't get out to space. So the level where that radiative balance is achieved is at, quote, the top of the atmosphere. It's not quite the top of the atmosphere, but it's above most of the atmosphere. Now, if you put more greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, that level at which the radiative balance occurs has to rise to a slightly higher level, because you put more absorbing greenhouse gases for the radiation to escape, it has to get above that extra greenhouse gas component. So it rises to a higher level. Now, this is in part of the atmosphere where the temperature decreases with elevation. So if you raise the level of the radiative balance, you're now radiating at a colder temperature, and therefore less radiation is going out, so now you're out of balance. But that sigma T to the fourth will rapidly bring you back in balance by warming the atmosphere until the radiation is sufficient to be back in balance. The way Tyndall described it, he said, the atmosphere is like a dam. It allows the heat to deepen until it reaches the lip of the dam, and then it spills out at exactly the same rate it enters, just like water in a dam. It's a wonderfully prescient description, which is exactly accurate, a description of the greenhouse, well, not exactly accurate, but it's not a bad description of the greenhouse effect as I've just described it. And it wasn't really until the 1960s that this understanding of what the greenhouse effect really is was worked out, first and foremost by Suki Manabe, who is presently at emeritus at Princeton University. Now, Tyndall didn't know why carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere might change. In fact, this had been more or less worked out by a French ceramicist named Abelman, who worked at the École des Mines in Paris. But unfortunately, Abelman died at a relatively early age, and as far as I can tell, Tyndall was unaware of his work. And what Abelman worked out was that carbon dioxide dissolved in rainwater forming carbonic acid reacts with crustal rocks forming a solution of cations and bicarbonate, which are then washed into the ocean and precipitated as calcium carbonate and silica, mostly as microscopic fossils, which then accumulate on the seafloor. The reactions are not as simple as this. This involves aqueous chemistry in rainwater, in pore water, in river water, and in seawater, but the overall reaction looks something like this. CO2 is pulled down, calcium carbonate and chert are deposited on the seafloor, and of course, plate tectonics does a bigger cycle, which then puts the CO2 from here back into the atmosphere. We'll come back to that later. But variations in the rate of crustal rock weathering are one of the things that could account for changes in the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere and therefore of the Earth's climate. Now, this controversy over the quaternary glacial deposits led to great interest in climate in the geological past. And so this is a diagram which shows the last 500 million years of Earth history. So the quaternary is squeezed right up against the far right-hand side of this. And these white bars represent the extent of glacial ice and sea ice from the south or the north pole towards the equator over different periods of time. And what you can see here is that we are presently in a glacial period, which are indicated by these pale blue bars. But there are much longer periods when there are no ice sheets at all. So the Earth's climate seems to be in either one or the other of two states. Either you have some ice sheets or you have no ice sheets. And the next glacial period, older as you go backwards in time from the Cenozoic ones, are these here, which I've called the Gondwana ice sheets, and they're around 300 million years old. And the existence of these glacial deposits followed directly on the heels of the glacial controversy of the mid-19th century. And this shows a map, and the black areas are the distribution of these 300 million-year-old glacial deposits, Carboniferous and Permian in age. Also shown here are the dates in which they were discovered. And as you can see from this map, this distribution indicates a very strange thing about the climate. In the southern hemisphere, the glacial deposits cover almost the entire hemisphere, whereas in the northern hemisphere, there are no glacial deposits at all. And that seems very strange, baffling, really, to a climate scientist. And very quickly, these deposits were studied, and people worked out the directions of flow of the ice. And in almost every case, with one exception, the ice flows off the ocean onto the land. How strange is that? And a young German meteorologist and climatologist named Alfred Wegener remarked that this Carboniferous glaciation represents a hopeless riddle to anyone who does not dare to accept the possibility of lateral motions of the continents. And so he proposed, primarily on the basis of this climatological evidence, because as a meteorologist and climatologist, that's what he was most familiar with and most confident that it was a phenomenon that required some extraordinary hypothesis, posited that 300 million years ago, these continents were all clustered together, and since that time, the continents have broken apart as a result of the opening up of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean at the expense of the Pacific Ocean, the theory of continental drift. And so here's a diagram of the continents in his reconstruction. The blue spots are the glacial deposits. The yellow and brown spots are dunes and salt. So these are the subtropic areas of high evaporation. And then most of the cols form along the equator with some exceptions in the mid-latitudes, and these cols have fossil wood that has rings, annual rings indicating seasonality, and these do not because they were formed on the equator. And this correlation with this reconstruction was so impressive that Wegener remarked in his first paper on continental drift in 1912 that if you reconstruct the continents this way, everything mysterious about the problem disappears. Incidentally, people with sharp eyes will notice that there's one blue dot here that seems to be out of place, a glacial deposit that's right on the equator. Wegener put this one in brackets, and he said, there's something wrong with this deposit. Either it's not glacial or it's not Carboniferous. And the visitors from Boston may recognize this as the Squantum tillite, which of course is not Carboniferous. It is glacial, but it's Precambrian in age. So Wegener got that one right. Pretty good for a non-geologist. Now, Wegener wouldn't have been so confident if he had looked back another 300 or 400 million years back to this period here called the Cryogenian. And here we have something very strange indeed. For a period of just over 80 million years, with the exception of a small interval, a little intermission here, of not more than about 10 or 15 million years near the end, for the rest of that 80 million year period, it appears that the entire Earth was covered by ice sheets. Now, the way we recognize the ice sheets of this age are exactly the same way we would recognize Quaternary ice sheets, the same phenomenon. Here's a glacial till from northwestern Australia. Here is a faceted and striated clast. Here's a moraine. These are all Cryogenian in age, sitting on a striated glacial pavement. Here are some marine sediments with ice-rafted dropstones. Here are sediments that are deformed as a result of being overridden by ice, grounded ice, in the marine environment. These are all the same kinds of criteria we use to recognize ancient glacial deposits in younger times. But this is the strange thing. These Cryogenian deposits are widespread on every continent. So these are the older ones. This is before the intermission, and this is after the intermission. And basically, there, everywhere, you have rocks of Cryogenian age. Where there are no dots, this is the Canadian Shield, there aren't any rocks that young that are present there. Otherwise, I'm sure we would find evidence. Now, this realization of the great extent of these deposits was first recognized, really, in the 1960s, which was also the time of acceptance of Wegener's continental drift theory. And so in enthusiasm over continental drift, geologists said, oh, we can explain this. These aren't all the same age. This just represents the movement of different continents over the polar regions at different times. Because at that time, they didn't know the age of these glacial deposits. They thought it could represent an interval as long as 200 million years rather than only 80. But even 200, when you think about it, would be very difficult to move all those continents across the pole in such a short period of time. But people thought, in their enthusiasm over continental drift and plate tectonics, that maybe that was possible, and that could be a way out of the idea that the entire Earth was covered with ice. So what we really need is some way of demonstrating at what latitude those glacial deposits actually formed. Because if you could prove that there was ice at sea level at the equator, or near the equator, because the temperatures across the tropics are broadly uniform, if you could prove that there was grounded ice at sea level near the equator in the tropics in the warmest area, then obviously colder areas would have been frozen as well. So that cuts right through the problem of correlation. Okay? If you have ice in the warmest area, the colder areas must have been frozen as well, and so correlation of those deposits would not be surprising. And you wouldn't really have to prove it a priori. So now I'm going to move forward to the present. So this is our present view of what we think the distribution of the continents that existed at that time was at the beginning of the Cryogenian and at the end of the Cryogenian. And the continents for which there are direct paleomagnetic constraints on the latitude, because paleomagnetism tells you latitude because at the equator, the magnetic lines of force are horizontal, and at the poles, they are vertical. And there's a simple mathematical relationship, assuming this time-averaged form of the magnetic field, which incidentally is very erratic and changes rapidly on all timescales. But if you average it over thousands of years, it looks like this. So it's a statistical game. You can tell the latitude from the inclination, which, if you're fortunate, is encoded in the ancient remnant magnetization of certain rocks. So the screws represent the continents for which we have direct paleomagnetic constraints at this time. The other continents are positioned by interpolation using paleomagnetic data from before or after the glacial period, or from tectonic correlations between continents that are adjacent in this depiction, and also from the known configuration of Gondwanaland, where most of these continents were 500 million years ago, not too long after the glacial period, and an inference about how the continents were clustered in the previous supercontinent of Rodinia at around a billion years. So for the onset of the glaciation, North America, called Laurentia, here we are right here, if I can hold my thing right there. So North America is straddling the equator at this time, and at the end of the glaciation, we don't have a direct constraint for North America, but Australia is also very close to the equator. And what I'm now going to show you is the distribution of the glacial deposits on this map, which was constructed without reference to glacial deposits. So as you can see, the glacial deposits are widespread, including continents which are pinned on the equator by paleomagnetic data, and there are many glacial deposits which are very close to the equator, including some where you can demonstrate that there was grounded ice in the marine environment. Now, incidentally, this paleogeography is tailor-made to produce a cold climate. And that is true for a number of reasons. First, continents have higher albedo than seawater. That is, they reflect more of the incoming radiation. That's particularly true in the Proterozoic when there were no forests. So continents look more like the Sahara Desert than they do like the Congo Basin. This is a very unusual paleogeography. More than 65% of total continental area is in the tropics. There has never been another time in the last billion years where the continents were in this kind of a configuration, with so many continents in low latitudes. Now, that's going to make for a colder climate because it increases the Earth's albedo. More of the solar radiation is being reflected. And in a modern climate model, the difference in the climate is as much as 5 degrees between this continental configuration and the modern one, just by changing the position of the continents and its effect on the albedo. In addition to that, if you remember Abelman, the consumption of carbon dioxide by weathering, if you put more of the continents in the warm, wet tropics, you are going to increase the global rate of weathering, and therefore the rate of consumption of carbon dioxide will also increase. And so you're going to have lower carbon dioxide and therefore a colder climate. And finally, coincident with the onset of the Cryogenian was the eruption of a large area of flood basalt in Arctic Canada, an area at minimum of 2,400 kilometers across the Canadian Arctic. And at that time, this great flood basalt plateau was erupted right across the equator on an east-facing continental margin where it would have been directly facing the warm, moist trade winds. Now, during the eruptions, of course, the volcanism would slightly have increased the carbon dioxide concentration, but once the eruption stopped, this pile of basalt would have been accessible to weathering and would have weathered intensely and further drawn down carbon dioxide, and models suggest that the possibility that this in itself was sufficient to cause the entry into this glacial period. So to give you a little idea to compare this with the last glacial maximum, this is the snow line at present from the North Pole to the South Pole. This is the elevation above sea level. So in the tropics, the snow line today is about 5,000 meters above sea level. At the last glacial maximum, it was about 1,000 meters or so lower, but still around 4,000 meters. And so the situation in the Cryogenian is that the snow line was almost down to sea level. Okay? The ice can actually flow a little bit to elevation slightly below the snow line, but this must have been a dramatically colder climate than the one today. So geologists, of course, were completely befuddled by this. They had no idea how to explain this. But in this case, climate scientists were actually ahead of them. In the 1960s, when the true nature of the greenhouse effect was finally appreciated and was accepted by virtually all climate scientists said, wow, that means that the increase in carbon dioxide due to fossil fuel burning is going to change the climate. And we better try to make a model of the climate system, which we can then turn the dials on, increase the carbon dioxide or the equivalent solar radiative forcing, and see what happens so that we can predict somehow what we're in for. So now what they did was they started by doing something, by trying to make a model of something that was well known. Okay? Physicists are people you turn to when you want to do something that's simple but is really hard. And so what they did was they said, well, let's see if we can write a mathematical expression of the variation in the surface temperature of the Earth as a function of latitude. And this is something that's well known. We know it's warmer at the equator than it is at the pole. The main reason for that is in the high latitudes, of course, less light falls on an equivalent area, and so there's less light energy watts per meter squared as a unit of area. Now, that's easy to do. What's not so easy to do in a simple mathematical expression is to describe the transport of heat from the tropics towards the poles that's done by the circulation of the atmosphere and the oceans. So for these early models, they couldn't do that in any kind of real dynamical way. They just did it in a diffusive mathematical approximation that gave the right answer. Because, of course, we know well what the variation in the mean annual surface temperature is as a function of latitude, and what they mean by that as the globally average temperature for a given latitude as you go around the Earth. So it's really the mean annual zonal mean surface temperature. So you can see it makes quite a bit of difference. If you didn't have any ocean atmosphere dynamics, the profile would look like this. It'd be much colder at the poles, much warmer at the equator. With dynamics, the gradient is much less severe. Now, they also had to put in their model, they had to account for changes in the planetary albedo, in the reflectiveness of the Earth, which is due to the surface, forested or non-forested, the clouds, and also surface areas which are covered by ice. And they found in their models that when you change the radiative forcing or the CO2 forcing, the extent of ice in a partly ice-covered planet was extremely important. Because when it gets colder, the area of ice gets larger, so more of the incoming radiation is reflected back to space and lost, so there's an additional cooling effect that's just due to the feedback from the change in the reflectiveness of the Earth. And it works in both directions. If it gets warmer, the ice gets smaller, the Earth absorbs more radiation, so there's an additional warming effect. Now, because of the shape of the Earth, as ice caps get larger and larger, for each increment of advance, the area of the ice cap gets, the change gets bigger and bigger. The feedback gets stronger and stronger, and as soon as they ran these models and changed the solar forcing, they found there was an instability. And in fact, they found there was two instabilities. What they found was that if you warm things up so that the polar caps got smaller and smaller, you reached a point where the polar caps were so small that the polar regions became warmer than the freezing point, and the caps just disappeared in the model. And so there was no possibility of having a very, very small ice cap, and this was called the small ice cap instability. The small ice cap instability turned out not to be a very robust solution because it's very sensitive to the geography in the polar regions, so it's not so important in modern climate models. But this instability is very robust and exists in modern climate models as it does in these very simplified early ones. And basically, the situation is if the polar cap gets too big, the surface temperature falls below freezing everywhere, and the entire Earth freezes over, at least in the model. And that means there's no possibility, according to these models, of having an ice line that is less than around somewhere between 30 and 40 degrees. If you get to that point, then the feedback becomes a lot stronger than the forcing, and the ice, within a period of a decade or so, these two ice caps meet at the equator and you have a completely ice-covered globe. And this is one of the first things that came out of these early climate models, and it greatly stimulated climate models because physicists thought that there had to be something wrong with the model. And they spent a lot of time, almost 10 years, trying to figure out what was wrong with the model. Because, of course, they assumed that this had never happened because they didn't know of any way of escaping from this situation. So Joe Kirschfink, who is a biomagnetist and a paleomagnetist at Caltech, he was the first geologist to pay attention to this climate model solution and say, maybe that's what happened in the cryogenium. He was the first person to take that climate model result and say, this actually happened. And he also invented this term, snowball Earth. This is the way he thought the Earth would look from outer space. And it's such a provocative name that it's still in common use, and it's actually just the name itself has done quite a bit to promote this idea. Now, you remember that the geological evidence we have indicates for certain that there were dynamic ice sheets at this time. There was flowing ice. You couldn't have produced those striated pavements, the moraines, many of the features that we see. So how to account for the development, the growth, the thickening of an ice sheet? Because the ice sheet will not slide unless it's near the melting point at the base. And to be near the melting point at the base, if the surface air temperature is very cold, the ice has to be very thick. And initially, in the snowball Earth, this looked like a problem because how were you going to thicken those ice sheets if the ocean was frozen? Where would the water vapor come from to make the snow that would accumulate as an ice sheet? Now, it turns out that in the snowball Earth, you still have a dynamic atmosphere. And so, therefore, there are some places where the ice is sublimating, is going directly from the solid state to water vapor, and other places where that water vapor was condensing, not as snowflakes, but as little tiny hexagonal prisms of snow. And there's a strange thing about the snowball Earth. This is a diagram which shows net precipitation upwards. That means precipitation is greater than evaporation. And when you have the reverse, net evaporation is downwards. And the dotted blue line is the present Earth as a function of latitude from the North Pole to the South Pole. Here's the equator. So the tropics are wet. They have net precipitation. The subtropics are dry. They have net evaporation. That's because the Hadley cells of the atmosphere, and the mid-continents have net precipitation. In the totally frozen state, you have a very different situation for reasons I'll explain to anyone who's interested after the talk. You have strong net evaporation right at the equator in the deep tropics, and you have net condensation everywhere else. And so that means that glacials will grow in this region here as a result of sublimation in a narrow band along the equator. Now note that the amount of water vapor being thrown around is very small relative to the normal state, about two orders of magnitude less. So this accretion right here of snow is only 3 millimeters or so per year. But 3 millimeters per year of snowfall accumulation, net accumulation, is 3 kilometers in a million years, and we have a lot of million years to play with, 82. To be exact. So in fact, this is not a problem. You will inevitably build up ice sheets to be thick enough so that they will be at the melting point of their base and be dynamic and transport sediment. So how do you get out? Okay, so this is the geochemical cycle of carbon. This is Ebelman. Okay, this is the weathering of rocks which consumes CO2. CO2 is buried in the form of carbonate and organic matter, and then plate tectonics heats up those sediments when they get subducted, and the CO2 comes back out of volcanoes, and that's the cycle. But in snowball Earth, the weathering is greatly attenuated. And there are a number of reasons for that. Probably the most important one is that CO2 in the atmosphere is soluble in liquid water, in rainwater, forming carbonic acid, but it is not soluble in ice or snow. And so when surface temperatures are below freezing everywhere, there's no way of getting the CO2 out of the atmosphere. It doesn't mean there's no weathering. There's still seafloor weathering from CO2 that's going directly into seawater from submarine volcanoes. But the weathering rate, the consumption of CO2, is much, much less than it is in a normal climate. And as a result, carbon dioxide slowly builds up in the atmosphere. And if it builds up high enough, the greenhouse effect may become strong enough to actually melt the snowball Earth despite its high albedo. And if that was true, that would surely indicate that CO2 is a mighty powerful greenhouse agent. So this is a diagram that now that shows the ice line latitude. So this is 90 degrees. This is at the pole, just one hemisphere. So this is no ice. This is all ice if the ice line latitude is down at the equator. This is the solar flux relative to the present. So here's the present here. This is more solar flux. This is less solar flux. This is the equivalent CO2, more CO2, less CO2. So here we are now. And if the CO2 goes down, the ice will move towards the equator on this line, and this is the point of the instability. And from here, the ice meets at the equator, and you go into the snowball Earth. And now you have to wait. This takes about 10 years, according to the most recent models. Now you're in a snowball Earth from anywhere from 5 to 50 million years, approximately, allowing the CO2 to build up 1, 2, perhaps three orders of magnitude in concentration to something like 100,000 ppm of CO2 you would require, according to models, which are not very well determined, actually, because we don't really know the greenhouse effect of CO2 at very high concentrations. But ultimately, according to this theory, the greenhouse effect gets high enough and strong enough that you begin to melt the ice at the equator. And now you're substituting white ice with dark water. That dark water absorbs more solar radiation, so there's a warming effect. And so now that positive feedback drives the deglaciation to completion very rapidly, probably in a few thousand years. So you have a catastrophic, rapid deglaciation with the result that the white ice disappears, so now you have a much darker surface, so it's much warmer, but you still have this huge overload of CO2. So the prediction is that this period immediately following the snowballer should be extremely warm because of lower albedo and yet high CO2 radiative forcing. So the temperatures, the global mean surface temperatures look something like this. Probably at the beginning of the glaciation, it's about minus 40 degrees. Depends a bit on how much dust there is in the air and in the ice and things like that. Unlike quaternary glaciations, the temperatures get warmer towards the end of the glaciation. Quaternary glaciations actually get colder towards the end. These get warmer towards the end. Makes them somewhat more difficult to test because the deposits are mostly from the warmest period rather than the coldest period. And then afterwards, you can have mean surface temperatures that might be as high as 40 degrees above freezing. That's a global mean surface temperature of 40 degrees. This is surely the hottest climate that the Earth would have ever experienced coming immediately after the end of the snowball glaciation. So this is something that can be tested, of course. And I'm not going to describe this because this is very technical, but here are four isotope systems, some of which we're going to be discussing at our geobiology conference here at McGill tomorrow. And there are people in the room who have contributed to this, and these are various things that test either the concentration of the CO2, the change in temperature, or the change in the pH, which is the acidification of the ocean. So as the CO2 goes up, the ocean becomes more acidic, because carbon dioxide in the presence of water forms a solution of carbonic acid. So where does the snowball Earth controversy sit at the present time? So here is another histogram of the number of papers per year over geologic time, and it gives a fairly clear pattern. This obviously is the period of neglect. We are obviously now in the period of hysteria. And I would say we are just about to enter the period of rejection. And the period of rejection is actually a very good time to get into snowballer studies because hopefully not more than 20 years from now, you'll be in a good position to be in the vanguard during the revival, during the period of acceptance. So now we're talking about acidification, and acidification is one of the things we're concerned about because of the rise of CO2. So anyone who's experienced indigestion, and this is nearly my last slide, knows that the antidote is to take some tablets of chewable calcium carbonate. Now, if you've had to use these tablets, you know three things about them. First of all, you have to eat a surprising number of those tablets, right? Three or four doesn't usually do it. It's usually more like six or eight. So you have to have quite a few tablets. And the second thing you know is that you don't feel better right away. Okay? You eventually do feel better, but it takes some time. An hour, 2 hours, sometimes even 3 hours. And the third thing you know is that once you've started to feel better, you don't feel perfectly well. You feel a lot better. You feel almost completely well, but not completely. You're still about 10% that you're not as good as you would like to be. Okay? Now, the ocean is a lot bigger than your stomach. And so you can imagine how many tablets the ocean has to take. And you also can imagine how long the ocean has to wait for those tablets to take effect, because you have to wait until that calcium carbonate dissolves. Now, fortunately for us, the tablets that the ocean has that it takes for this problem are a lot smaller than the tablets you use. The ocean's bigger, but the tablets are smaller. These are the tablets that the ocean relies on. And these, Coccolis, they dissolve. And how long you have to wait until the ocean feels better is essentially determined by how long it takes for enough of these coccolithophores to dissolve to buffer the CO2. And even then, it can't buffer it completely because these are equilibrium reactions, so you're not getting rid of all of the CO2, but you're getting rid of most of it. In the end, to get rid of all of it, you have to rely on those silicate weathering reactions of Abelman, and that takes hundreds of thousands of years. Now, the time scale for the dissolution of these coccolis for the ocean to feel better is thought from models to be a minimum of a few thousand years. Okay. So even though it's only going to take us 200 or 300 years to jack up the CO2, it's going to take thousands of years for the ocean to adjust to that overload of CO2 and for the CO2 to start to come down, even for it to come down to 60-70% of its to remove much but not all of that overload of CO2. It could take 100,000 years or more to get back to normal. So what would a geologist see if some imaginary geologist from outer space came to Earth 20 or 30 years, million years into the future, and started poking around looking for evidence of the geologic history of the Earth? What would they see that would reflect our existence? Well, I think one of the most impressive things they would see is something that we can see looking back 56 million years, as it turns out, as shown here in a number of deep-sea cores from the South Atlantic Ocean. And these cores consist mostly, during normal times, of these pale-colored sediments, and these sediments are largely coccolis, little calcareous skeletons of coccolithophores. There is a sprinkling of forams in here as well, but it's mostly coccolis. The percent calcium carbonate is shown in these blue diagrams here. This is nearly 100%. And this dark band here is the so-called PETM, the Paleocene-Eocene transition, which occurred 56 million years ago approximately. And at that time, for a period estimated to be 60,000 years, the calcium carbonate concentration fell to zero over much of the depth of the ocean. The lysocline, the level of saturation of calcium carbonate, actually rose in the ocean by around 2 kilometers. So this was a major acidification event. And it's associated with important extinctions of bottom-dwelling organisms like foraminifera, and also, incidentally, massive extinctions of terrestrial mammals. That's why the beginning of the Eocene was put there, because this was an important event, and this is a manifestation of that. And this is a result of the acidification. Now, the absence of coccolis at this time is not because the coccolis went extinct. In fact, at this time, the surface-dwelling organisms were not seriously affected. It's because the coccolis didn't survive as they settled through the water column into the more acidic, deeper waters. They just all dissolved. And so no coccolis reached the bottom. Not because they became extinct, but simply because the ocean was so acidic. So that event, this PETM, is this little spike right here. This is a plot of temperature. It's actually plotted here as polar ocean surface temperature, which is broadly equivalent to deep sea ocean bottom temperature. And this is some oxygen isotopes. So this is actually temperature. This is the warming that coincides with that dissolution event. And it is the closest analog, natural analog we have to the anthropogenic experiment in acidification of the ocean through fossil fuel burning. It's a different time, and it's different in many ways. The first important difference is the world was much warmer at that time than it is today. And you might think that would be lucky for us, because coming from a colder world, we have a bit of a buffer. But on the other hand, we know that colder climates with a lot of ice tend to have a much stronger reaction to changes in greenhouse forcing because of the ice albedo feedback, which didn't exist at this time because there wasn't any ice. The more important difference, however, is that in the Paleocene, the outpouring of CO2, which I think was probably from the North Atlantic Igneous Province, although and plus some organic carbon that was liberated as well, although we're actually uncertain what the source of the CO2 was 56 million years ago. The important point is that the duration of the CO2 outgassing is now believed to be on the order of 60,000 years, although the initial pulse of it was shorter than that, maybe 10,000 years. Now, in contrast, the acidification, the CO2 that we're doing due to fossil fuel burning is being done in 200 or 300 years. And the reason why that's important is that the entire ocean overturns and mixes on about a million year time, on a 1,000 year time scale. So if the CO2 forcing is on many thousands of years, even tens of thousands of years, the entire ocean can take up the CO2. Whereas in our case, in the Anthropocene, as it's called, the time scale of the CO2 output is much shorter than the ocean mixing time, and that means that the entire acidification is being borne by the surface ocean only. And so that means that the acidification that we're producing is going to be much, much more damaging to the surface ocean, which, of course, is where most of the organisms that live in the ocean live. So I think the impression from climate science and geology is that the climate change that is due primarily to fossil fuel burning, although we're not in a position to predict with accuracy the effects of that on a regional scale, and in fact, the effects are only now beginning to emerge from the natural variability on the global scale, and you can't even see it on the regional scale yet because the natural variability is much larger on the regional scale than on the global scale. Nevertheless, I think we can safely predict that the Anthropocene will be a climate change that will introduce a period of time that will be geological in magnitude and duration. And with that, I hope I've told you something useful about the three histories, the history of climate science, the history of geology, and the climate history of the Earth itself. And so anyone who's interested in further perusing these slides can download them from this URL, and hopefully I've left time for some questions. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, yes, we do have some time for questions. I have no doubt there are questions out there.
Yeah?
Could a snowballer scenario happen again, given that now we have terrestrial multicellular organisms, both on land and in the ocean?
The sun is getting brighter all the time, and so that makes it less likely. And if it is true that the previous snowball Earth is fundamentally due to an unusual configuration of the continents, we're in a completely different continental configuration at the present time. We have less than only about 35% of continental areas now in the tropics, as opposed to 65%. So we can't say that that might never happen again, but it would have to be a long time in the future. So I don't think snowball Earth is anything we have to worry about. It's an area of science that will never kill anybody or make it, or maybe me, but will never make anybody rich. Yeah.
Could
is not known for certain, but the combined effects of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is probably the most likely to fail, and the Greenland ice sheet would be around 7 meters or so. But that's because earlier estimates of the West Antarctic ice sheet said 6 meters, but more recent estimates are more like 3. So it's a little bit uncertain, but it's a few meters. Okay, and given that this warmth is likely to last for several thousand years, it seems inevitable that in time the West Antarctic and much of the Greenland ice sheet will disappear, although we don't know the time scale of that disappearance.
Will that change the salinity of the ocean?
Yes. Yeah, it will decrease the salinity. Yes.
We had the International Geophysical Year.
Yeah.
And then Sputnik came along, and all the money went into space. And at that point, I remember they were going to drill to the Moho line, Moravec's line,
yeah,
somewhere, and it was very expensive.
Yeah.
And too short a slide of the mantle and the core and that.
Yeah.
Is the Moho line very important in all this discussion? Because there's not much known about it.
Yeah.
What has happened over the last 60 years?
Well, what's happened is that we found out that the Moho is actually exposed on land. So we didn't need to drill for it after all, because we can actually go out and look at it. There's a beautiful example of it in western Newfoundland. However, the ocean drilling project did go ahead. And a guy at Miami named Cesare Emiliani said, while you're drilling down to the Moho, don't throw away the sediments at the top of the core, because they might be useful for telling changes in temperature in the past. And in fact, it were those cores that, of course, became a huge international scientific research program that really initiated modern paleoclimate studies. And in the next issue of, well, I don't know, are you a member of the Geological Association of Canada?
I'm a mining engineer.
Yeah. Well, you should become a member of the GAC, because in Geoscience Canada, the issue that will be coming out online in the next week or so, I have tried to tell an amusing story, in part the result of a talk I heard this guy Emiliani give when I was a graduate student, about the early history of telling temperature in the past from deep sea cores.
So you don't have to drill 10 kilometers to find a hole?
No, we do not. It's exposed on land in a number of places.
All right.
Enjoy the movie.
Yes.